It's all part of the plan. DC Talk here and Get Into Gig, episode 24. We're talking all things DC on the big and little screens. And at the end of the episode, we will get back to some more small screen stuff, my journey through the old school DC TV. But we're going to talk about some big screen stuff, guys, because each and every week I sort of sign off saying, gee, I hope we've got something exciting to talk about next week, and we get little bits of information. And oh, I really hope that we're going to get something. Maybe a release date for Creature Commandos, I think, was the last thing that I hoped for. And here we are, March 1st, obviously, Feb 29, over in the US of A, and we get a couple of, I'm going to, like, they're big bombs, right? They're excitable stuff. If you're like me, if you're excited about the DCU, I had quite the morning here with some of those reveals that were coming through. All of a sudden it's that, hey, Superman Legacy, no longer called Superman Legacy. Oh my God, what are they going to do with it? Now they're calling it Superman. Okay, to be honest, I actually really like the title change. Not so much the Superman part of it, but the non-Superman Legacy. I think I've made no secret in the past talking about the DCU plans, especially when they announced the slate a little over a year ago, that especially when it comes to Batman, the Brave and the Bold situation, if it's supposed to be about, hey, we've got an aged up Batman, he's going to already have had a son, and whether or not they're going to sort of rewrite some stuff that no other Robins existed, or that he is in fact the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, who knows what they're going to do? He's going to be the umpteenth Robin in line like it is in the comics, and we're going to have lost a lot of the Batman history that I know a lot of the films in the past have focused on and have told stories in and around, but I still feel like there's a lot there to have mind. I don't want Batman Forever and Batman and Robin to be not the definitive, but to be, I guess, the most well-known cinematic telling of the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson and Batman and Robin. I don't want that. I want to see actors and characters with longevity in a franchise explore that really interesting relationship between those two characters that, I mean, it just can't be done in, I mean, two films are certainly a long time, but I feel like in the 90s it wasn't necessarily, especially when it came to Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. Hey, like, shout out to High Bitch Maddie. I know you love your Batman and Robin. I know you love your Batman Forever. You certainly love your Michael Keaton Batmans. But I feel like those were very, very character-driven. And if we ever get that Schumacher cut of Batman Forever, then we're going to really see what they were cooking there. Batman and Robin, though, hey, there's some dramatic moments. And sure, George Clooney has a couple of key scenes where he's wearing a turtleneck and thinking about who he is and what he wants to be. But generally speaking, they didn't really knuckle down and explore the Bat character and explore who Dick Grayson was, other than maybe having a little bit of a tantrum about being the sidekick. You know, I want to see what becomes of those characters. So I don't want another aged up Batman. A lot of people had a problem with Ben Affleck's Batman because he was old when we meet him. We didn't get to see what made him. It was just show him 20 years into his career, and then we're going to have a Henry Cavill Superman just starting his career, and we're going to throw them together and see what happens. And people complained a lot. We need something fresh. We need to go back to basics. Okay, great. We get the DCU, and their plan is to have a not-so-new Superman, but a new-ish Superman, and also Batman, when he comes into it into a couple of years, he's going to have already had a son with Talia al Ghul, and we're going to have Damian Wayne sitting there, and he's going to be, you know, in his early teens. And it's like, isn't that exactly where, I mean, shy of the Damian Wayne thing, which, I mean, had they have made another Zack Snyder Justice League or another Ben Affleck Batman somewhere along the line, they could have written that in. It wouldn't have retconned anything that we learnt along the way. So aren't we just treading similar territory to what we already had? I would love to have started off with your David Corenswet Superman, who, he's a young guy. We've got him playing a youngish Superman, a newish Superman. Give us a youngish Batman, maybe a couple of years older, but with an actor that looks youthful enough that can play the character for the next 10, 15 years. Give us a Robert Downey Jr. equivalent of Batman. I don't know who that is. I hope that we get that with David Corenswet. I hope that we get that with Rachel Brosnahan playing Lois Lane. I hope we get that with Nicholas Holt's Lex Luthor. If we're putting these people in these roles and we're hoping for success, and even if you hate the DCU and you love the Snyderverse, is the answer really that we get another failed DC universe of whatever sort they're putting together now? Love it or hate it, the Snyderverse, it's come to an end because it just, black or white, it didn't work. There are moments I love in across all of those movies. There are movies in there that I really, really enjoy, and others that I will really defend, and some that I didn't like so much. I don't know that I ever really loathed any of those films. There's ones that I never have a need to go back to, but I never hated anything. But love it or hate it, it didn't work. We needed to do something different, and that's what we're getting with the DCU. And I don't think the answer to not liking the DCU or James Gunn or his plans or the fact that you feel like he backstabbed Zack Snyder or that Warner Brothers did Snyder dirty, whatever the discourse is on the DCU and coming out of the Snyderverse, the answer is not that I hope that DC as a brand, as a franchise, fails again at Warner Brothers. We can blame Warner Brothers all we want, but the pundits don't know that. Joe Public doesn't understand that Warner Brothers is going to be to blame. They're just going to think, well, Superman doesn't make a great movie. The Flash is a shitty character to go and see cinematically. Whatever character it is they're trying to shove at our faces, once we sit there and we tick all the boxes, hang on, all these bad films that people generally don't seem to connect to are all in these DC. They have the DC branding at the start. And that's going to cost the franchise. That's going to cost the brand of DC. And you don't want to do that to Superman. You don't want to do that to Batman. I think them as a symbol, them as a character will survive that. But you still don't need that many X's against those characters' names. So I genuinely want this to succeed and to do well. And I want longevity out of these characters. What the MCU did so well with Tony Stark's Iron Man, and even though the Fox X-Men didn't necessarily work, what we got from Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart playing those characters since the beginning of the Fox X-Men universe. And maybe with Deadpool, we get a Halle Berry Storm coming back and someone else from the beginning. But at this stage, Hugh Jackman coming back and Patrick Stewart maybe coming back, but certainly in Logan had been playing that character for 17 years. I want that for the DCU. I want that from a Batman. I want to see him grow and grow his own Bat family. And if we are going to get to a point where he has to move on, I want that to be in a long time. I've also made no secret that I don't want the DCU to move time-wise like the MCU does. The MCU exists and plays out in real time. These actors are playing appropriately aged characters. They get to the end of their tenure, they retire from the role, and those characters seemingly retire from the franchise or die off. I think DCU can go the way of the James Bond franchise. David Corenswet plays his character for 12 years. Someone else comes in and plays the exact same Superman. Batman is played for 8 years by one actor. He decides he wants to leave. Someone else comes in and picks up the exact same role and just continues it on. And we could have this franchise go on 20 years. Might seem like a bit of a fantasy at this point. That's a long time. But I mean, the MCU is nearing that itself. And Batman and Superman are these iconic, nearly century-old characters. Like, I think that they can do that. So I think we want to see this succeed. We want to see it move on. And Superman is what is going to be the beginning point of that, certainly in a cinematic point of view. So I don't think naming the first film Legacy about what potentially you're setting up to leave behind is necessarily what I want the first film in an entire franchise to be about. Now, that might be oversimplifying exactly what that title might mean, but in the early talk that was about, hey, he and Lois are already together. They already have a young son. That doesn't mean Jonathan Kent is going to be 10 years old, learning it from his father. But if we're already moving to that stage of the character, that seems pretty fast to me. Like, we don't necessarily have to cover the same ground that we did with those characters in a Brandon Routh Superman or a Henry Cavill or Christopher Reeve or anything and tell the same stories. But at the same time, I want to exist in an already existing world. Lex Luthor has already met Superman. They've already come to blows, but I want to see their next big battle, even though we never saw the first one. And I think that we can build off that. But also then if that happens to Superman and it gets renamed from Superman Legacy to Superman, can we do that to Batman as well and not necessarily give him a son and make him, you know, early 50s already? Can we push that back a little bit? I want to see him bring in Robin as like a mid-teenager and train him up and see that guy age up and then bring in another Robin and see Dick Grayson become Nightwing. We haven't even got the first animated television show, let alone feature film, and I'm already asking for big things. I get that. But this film is now known as Superman. It wasn't even a criticism, but one thing I saw on, I'm not going to call it X, Twitter said, well, if you're going to call this after one of the most iconic superhero films of all time that's nearly 50 years old, you better be damn confident in your own game. And my first thought was, hang on, that was called Superman the movie. It's called Superman. And even if it was called Superman the movie, we know exactly what they mean by that. So coming out and calling it Superman, probably not going to win over any fans that already hate James Gunn. Like, how dare you sully the name of the great Christopher Reeve and Richard Donner by naming your character, your movie about Superman after the character that it's based. It's a dumb argument. Call it Superman, and then the movie at this stage can still be anything they want it to be and formulate as it goes along. I mean, James Gunn himself, in the post that he put out our morning, American Last Night, Feb 29, said, "When I finished the first draft of the script, I called the film Superman Legacy. By the time I locked the final draft, it was clear the title was Superman. Making our way to you, July 2025. I like the idea that whatever the story was, maybe it has tweaked enough that we're not ready for Superman to have this as his legacy yet, or we want this to be more about Superman beginning. I mean, I don't know necessarily how to read that, but I think that I already like it because I wasn't ready yet for a legacy. I like the idea that it was Superman colon subtitle. I always love when a movie or a franchise starts out. The Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. They didn't name it Pirates of the Caribbean and then have to make a second one with a subtitle to set it apart. They already said, this is going to be a franchise and this one's about the Black Pearl. I love the overconfidence. Now, Superman had more chance of getting a sequel and becoming a giant franchise than Pirates of the Caribbean did back in 2003, but I appreciated the legacy. I just don't know that was my preferred title. I was ready to champion it if it was. Now that it's not, let's just cheer on Superman. The other part of his post was overjoyed to be announcing the start of principal photography. Finally, we're here, guys, on Superman. Today, February 29, which just so happens to be, coincidentally and unplanned, Superman's birthday. Now, last year they announced on Superman Day the script, the title, the film, a few other things along the way. Here we are, apparently unplanned, that on Clark Kent's birthday, Superman's birthday, February 29, only happens once in 4 years. They accidentally just so happen to be coincidentally starting production. I don't know that I necessarily buy it. I don't need to start calling the guy a liar. I don't know why he would lie when it's so obvious that it shouldn't be a lie. It doesn't matter. But with it, we get a shot of the S on the chest, which seems very textured. Not necessarily to the level of Henry Cavill's S, because that was very armorish. It was very, very detailed. This one, I mean, there's a lot of texture there. It looks more material than maybe Henry Cavill's did, but I liked the S, seemingly confirming the somewhat leaked, accidentally leaked by Isabella Merced from the table read that seemingly confirmed what the S symbol logo would be for this film. It seemed to be confirmed here with this post, and I like it. It's not an obvious S. It's obviously very much inspired by a version of that symbol from the comics, but it looks good. And initially, I'm looking at it thinking, I like the red. I like how rich that red is. I like that yellow. It's more of a gold rather than a yellow, but I like the color, the richness of it. And then it seemingly is covered in some type of snow scattered across the S, which is very close up. You don't even get the full logo, but you understand exactly what you're looking for. The blue, though, the blue looks very bright, and I like that. Are we going to go for something very loud, very comic influence, that royal blue, very, very loud blue? There's no other way to put it. I mean, the problem people had, well, one of the problems that people had with Henry Cavill's Superman was that it wasn't loud enough, that costume. It was a duller red. It was a duller yellowish gold. It was a dull blue. And I did see someone run it through a filter and whack it up on Twitter a couple of years after that film, and they had popped a bit more saturation on there. And the blue looked amazing. And that scene, the flight scene where he first learns to take off and Hans Zimmer's score roaring through, looked incredible because of the richness of the blue itself. Individually, just the blue set that entire scene in a completely different stratosphere. I absolutely loved it. Don't judge the movie because of that. And certainly in the, the time that movie was made, it probably wouldn't have fit to have had such a blue costume for Superman. I mean, they lost the trunks and that kind of fit with the tone and definitely the setting in the 2013 era of making a Superman costume, and certainly the world that movie existed in. But I think over the last couple of years, certainly helped by James Gunn with Guardians of the Galaxy, and in particular, I guess, his Suicide Squad, which it's about ridiculous characters with ridiculous powers and ridiculous names that are very much like F-grade characters in the DC universe. But he went all out to make a lot of those very comic accurate in a lot of different ways that it was a bit of a tester, really. I thought, let's see how the audience reacts to this. And no one really came away saying that movie sucked because of how comic accurate those characters and their costumes were. You liked it or you hated it for a bunch of different reasons. That wasn't necessarily the main one. So it's, what is he going to do with Superman? He's teased us for long enough about whether trunks were a thing, whether they weren't going to be a thing. We would have to put the trunks back on Superman. Cinematically, he doesn't have them. On TV, Superman and Lois, he doesn't have them. That's very much a Henry Cavill type outfit. But soon after the title change announcement and the peek at the movie's S, you would have seen these. Apparently leaked set photos were posted online showing off a full costume David Corin sweat in head to ankle Superman glory. His feet weren't in the photo. You've always got to take these photos with a grain of salt, though. I know that. But the S was correct, yeah? And the colours seemingly matching what was debuted by Gunn. I thought it looked incredible. Very comic-y in its loud colours, complete with trunks, in a boastful way, I thought, that really could set the tone of the movie and Superman's place in the greater DCU world. Like, a character that the filmmakers were unafraid of putting in such an unsubtle outfit. What could it tell us already about what this character is going to be like, and possibly the world that he's going to inhabit? I so wanted it to be true. Even though I knew it most likely wasn't, and we'll get to that in a sec, that I was kind of happy in the end anyway. So trust one fan to actually ask James Gunn about it on Threads. He asks, is the image circulating on the internet of David Corin sweat in Superman's costume, is it real or fake? Gunn replies, let's see, can the man on the left take a photo holding an amorphous black blob while looking through an eyeball on the front of his cap? Can the man on the right's torso grow out of his right hip? And can he be stupid enough to wear his pants with the drawstring in the back? Are David Corinsworth's hands made of wax without any bones or veins? And might Superman's trunks be knitted with yarn? Ask yourself these questions, and I'm certain you'll be able to answer them on your own. Yes, so pretty definitive that this is apparently not what we're getting. It may end up looking similar, but apparently this isn't it, which I'm actually happy for. Not necessarily the costume change, if it's going to be any different, but that this isn't our first official look. Like I've been saying for many episodes, boring you to tears with it, I want the actual look at Corin sweat in the costume for the first time to be from an official source in full HD and released when they want it to be seen. There is no rush. They're shooting indoors. I'm sure everyone's under NDAs. We will get it when they need us to get it. Just trying to set up some type of positive want and need and desire for this film. It probably won't last this long. We are in early March, but can you imagine that come July, when we get to San Diego Comic-Con, 1 year out from this movie's release, that the fans there get their first look at the costume with the cast and crew present. You can add to that that before or after, I forget who comes first, DC or Marvel, they might be showing off the Fantastic Four, either the cast for the first time together or in their costume, some kind of shot from their production going on as well. Hall H wouldn't know what hit it that day. It would be monstrous, and surely the biggest one in the last couple of years. Now, it wasn't the only denial that Gunn made during the last week. He also denied the rumored budget of the movie. If you somehow missed this, rumors over the last week, Superman would be carrying an almost $364 million budget. It tastes bad just speaking those words. Now, these claims were made after findings with the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit, which Warner Brothers are alleged to have made a tax credit application with them for $36.97 million, which equates to a little over 10% of the budget. Now, James Gunn came out on Threads denying those claims. A fan wrote in and asked him for clarification around the reports, which he simply replied with, absolutely not. Threw in a bit of a laugh emoji. How in the world do they think they know what our budget is? Now, for context, a $363 million budget would exceed every individual film from the DCEU lineup. There's a bit of confusion around the cost of Justice League because you've got reports having it at $300 million, but then there's also the $70 million extra to complete Zack Snyder's version of the film. But it's at least around $100 million more than Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice cost, and it's pushing $140 million more than the last Superman solo film in Man of Steel. You could almost make another Superman film for the alleged difference between the last one and this one. In fact, a $363 million budget would have Superman 2025 just miss out on making the top five list of most expensive movies of all time. But all five of those films were sequels in already established and successful franchises like Star Wars, Avengers, The Jurassics, and Pirates of the Caribbean. It made sense why they might have had way too big a budget, but certainly an inflated budget because they were already part of a franchise that had proved itself to make money. It was worth those risks. Now, Gunn has denied it, and I hope that he's telling the truth because $363 million is ludicrous to spend on one film, considering where the DC brand is on a cinematic level at the moment. I love a lot of these films, and I'll certainly defend some of them as well, but you can't deny that it's in a tough spot, especially with its diehard fans who you would otherwise expect to be there on opening day and absolutely go and watch everything that they're producing. Most of the diehard fans are engaged in some type of civil war. There's very few of us, and I do include myself in this niche party, that are able to exist in both worlds of, hey, I don't have to hate Snyder to love Gunn, or vice versa. I don't know. It's a dangerous world to be in. So either it's another fabricated lie from those people that do hate Gunn and want to make him look bad and power crazy at the top of the DC studios and just throwing out these massive budgets on films that he is writing and directing, even though most of the facts that the allegation, if we're going to call it that, is built on can easily be found on public record, which makes you think it might be more true than it is false, or Warner Brothers is taking another massive gamble in their ability to swing the public favor in just the next 16 months before that movie comes out and suddenly make everyone really want to see another movie that has DC next to it or another Superman film when the last couple haven't been financially as successful as what they might hope. Now, one thing Gunn hasn't spoken on, mainly because he doesn't need to, is the music for the film. We obviously had a new composer join the franchise a couple of weeks ago. I only bring it up, though, because of the new Lois Lane. The marvelous Rachel Brosnahan posted to TikTok a quick video shot in her trailer where a very bald Nicholas Hoult and an almost incognito David Corenswet briefly appear, all to the tune of John Williams' Superman score. Now, this means absolutely nothing. Of course it doesn't, but after what I spoke about a few episodes ago and wanting the characters in DC to be more like James Bond, especially Superman, maybe even Batman, and maybe Wonder Woman as well, and have the same music stay with the character. It doesn't have to change when you bring in a new actor to play them. My fanboy heart wants to think that James Gunn would specify to his actors or anybody that wants to post about this film and maybe production starting to not use anything from past iterations. Don't use the same logo. Don't use music, especially something as iconic as John Williams, if you're not going to turn around and use that. But my head then says it's just TikTok and who gives a shit? Righto, over to the DC TV world of old with my journey through the old Arrowverse. Up to season 7 of The Flash, and in this particular week when this stuff aired, no other show was on. It was The Flash and only The Flash with season 7, episode 16, POW. John Diggle arrives in Central City with a weapon to help Barry stop the Godspeed War. Allegra and Ultraviolet's new bond is put to the ultimate test while Joe and Kristen Kramer are hunted by a former colleague of hers. Which, of course, last week ended with them kind of hunting him, but we'll let that go. Now, to start from the very beginning, it's hilarious that we open with a dream scene of Barry. He's once again dreaming of his daughter. But even within the dream sequence, Iris isn't there and Barry still just yelling out to upstairs or to another room down the hall and getting absolutely nothing in response from the person that he's talking about. So I like that even his dreams, Iris still doesn't exist. She might be sick in the real world, but even in his dreams, she's still incapacitated and not to be seen. I want to say in every single episode of this show's entire run, at some stage we are going to see someone in a hospital bed or in a lab bed at Star Labs or elsewhere. We're going to see someone injured or recovering from a fight or seemingly dead or coming back to life. Whatever it is, someone's always injured. Someone's always laying in a bed. It's part of the story. And when they haven't included as much to explain why Iris isn't there, it's just she's sick. The idea that we don't see her is ridiculous. You could have written her out of the show. She could have been left on the island after her and Barry had their little romp a week or two ago, and just she's taken some chill out time. And then when she's not there, it makes a little bit more sense. It's going to seem a little bit awkward when Barry's on the phone to her, only having one-sided conversations, and we don't hear even a muffled reply on the other end of the phone. But it's what they decided to do, and here we are living with it. And yet she shows up at the end of the episode, but we'll get there. Like I said the other week too, I love Diggle. He was great to show up in Batwoman. We absolutely didn't need him there, but it's nice to have seen him so long after Arrow wrapped up and somewhat carrying on what happened to him at the end of Arrow with that mysterious green glow. Ooh, what could that be? Very lanternish, right? We get a taste of that in Batwoman. He's coming to see the best doctors in America, somehow in the crime-riddled city of Gotham. But now he's making the move to come and help Barry and Team Flash in their Godspeed War, which, interestingly enough, I didn't realize that there wasn't a great deal of time between last week's end of the episode and this week's beginning. I just assumed there was at least a couple of days, maybe a week, because last week ended and it's like, yeah, the team knew what was going on and episode ended. This week starts officially and we get a newscast saying the Speedster War. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, this is something that's been established. People are out there. They're being attacked. They're being kidnapped. They're being killed. This is a big deal going on in the city. And about 10 minutes into the episode, you have Cecile say, oh, I haven't been able to speak to Joe. He left hours ago. And I'm thinking that was midway through last episode. Has there been like 10 minutes between these two episodes? Yet all of a sudden, the newsreader behind the desk at the TV studio is all of a sudden referring to this as a Speedster War. Okay. But going back to Diggle. I love Diggle. I want to see more of Diggle. And I hope that he keeps making dramatic entrances just like this.
I can't leave. Not while there's a civil war in the city.
Maybe I can help with that.
John?
Hey.
Barry? Caitlin? I brought you something.
What is it?
If we're lucky, a way to end this war before someone gets killed.
Not only must he have a key or some type of swipe card to be able to get into Star Labs whenever he wants because he's trustworthy, but he can do so without anybody noticing and get as far as where Barry and Caitlin were, and then to what, stand outside until he waited for a rhetorical question to which he could just bust in and say,
maybe I can help with that.
Now, we do get a little bit more about Diggle's condition in this episode. Still not a lot, but it obviously looks a little bit more painful here. In Batwoman, I guess there wasn't enough time to reestablish him to the franchise and then to go into what is going on with him, why he's in Gotham. We just get the little nugget there. Here he shows up very clearly suffering a lot of pain when he goes through some type of episode and finishes it by saying, Gotham weren't able to help me. I'll figure it out another time. What we clearly needed him for was to be the good angel on Barry's side. Barry's surrounded by good people, let's be honest. But we needed Diggle to do what he did for so many years with Oliver Queen and to be the better side of his conscience when Oliver was questioning whether to do a wrong thing for a right reason or to give up entirely on the other side of the coin. Diggle was always there as a nice moral compass. So here when we have Barry potentially about to face the idea of killing somebody before they're even a fully fledged bad guy, because it will end up stopping this great war and saving his family and saving the future, Barry's naturally questioning that. I mean, I guess it's not been as much of a story thread as maybe what the show thinks it is at this point with three episodes to go. But from very early on this season, when we were wrapping up season six properly in those first handful of episodes, through to the next couple of weeks worth of week-to-week villains, Barry's big thing has been about finding a different way to deal with people. When it comes to the big bads, the overall villains of the season, Barry doesn't want to kill them. When it comes to weak-to-weak villains, it's less about killing and more just about being more physically powerful than the villain and punching them into submission. Barry has still found better ways to deal with them than that. Not only about killing, just about less violence. But here we have Diggle saying, maybe there's a time for you to risk certain things. Not necessarily killing, maybe not even violence, but Barry's big thing is, I'm not like Oliver. I can't just kill someone or not kill someone. I can change timelines, and I'm not prepared to do that. Diggle, you should know better than anybody. I once changed the sex of your child. You went from having one to another, and you had completely forgotten about them, and you weren't entirely happy, but then you kind of forgave me about it because you didn't remember it anyway. Yet here, because of those things that Barry had changed, he had a different idea about how to handle things.
Besides, man, with this civil war destroying the city, staying here to fight is the right thing to do.
No, it's not. Barry, I lived a long life here on this earth. I've been a spy, a vigilante, a soldier. Hell, I've even been the Green Arrow. The most important job I've ever had is as a dad. And there's not a bullet I wouldn't take. There's not a timeline that I wouldn't risk changing if it meant protecting my family. I know that now. Lila. My kids, they're my heart, man. My soul. My entire world. How far would I go for them? As far as it takes. Everything else be damned. Don't be afraid to do the same.
Seemingly, we're at the end of Diggle's run on The Flash, at least for the moment. It's a part one, part two for the remaining two episodes of The Flash. Diggle seems to say goodbye at the end of this, even though it absolutely makes sense that he would stick around in a real-world situation, but you don't need to bring in any more outside help for The Flash when he's already got so many super-powered people on his team. We don't need to borrow someone from another show to come in and save the day. Otherwise, why would you ever get rid of them? So we're going to lose Diggle, and we've already lost Iris. They also had this other ridiculous line about why she's been missing.
I'd risk anything to keep this family safe.
Yeah, well, you and me both. Which is why I've been reading this.
Laura's journal?
Yeah, Iris gave it to me. Apparently, she has been looking for anything about the original August Heart. Yeah, I know. Even when she's under the weather, your girl is thinking of ways to help us now.
But then almost in the next scene, Iris is here, which is so strange. Not so much for last week. That could have very much been just some time off for Candace Patton. But here at the start of the episode, even though it was a dream sequence, when we have Barry yell out to Iris, I'm going to have to go off and protect the city. I just can't sit here doing nothing. That we didn't get Candace Patton providing a line of dialogue that they could have thrown in the background. We didn't need to see her on screen. Yet she shows up in full right here, someplace out of time with Dion protecting her and keeping her still so she doesn't fracture across time. There was a lot of science heavy talk in this episode, so in that way it actually did feel very Flash. It was just weird how the in-world story was almost trying to explain the meta filmmaking outside we're watching a television program reason why Candace Patton, the actress, was not actually in the show as Iris. All of this brought on because Barry believed that he was at risk of losing Nora as his daughter in the future. She was potentially dying. We were seeing a phasing out situation like Back to the Future. Marty McFly was watching his future, his past, disappear right in front of him. That's where Barry was stuck. So that's what was the motivation behind him doing what he was doing and making the decisions that he ended up making on top of the Godspeed War. And then you have Allegra and Esperanza, aka Ultraviolet, chasing down more bad guys loosely connected to her backstory, and then Esperanza seemingly dies. The moment that poor actress got to show off her full face and without a flanged voice, and she seemingly is dusted and floats off into ash. And then you've also got Joe and Kramer chasing down Adam Crake, Kramer's former brotherly type character turned betrayer from years before. There was a lot going on in this episode. Now, we've had an idea about Crake being some type of metahuman, but here he was facing off against Kramer for the first time, and he said, oh no, you're dead, who the hell are you? Which is asking even more questions of the Kramer backstory, which is confusing things with two episodes to go, because this season started off with Kramer as a very human bad guy, seemingly want to end all metas or at least lock them up. We've then turned the corner a little bit. She is now a misunderstood hero. She is just simply trying to track down the person who wronged her, who may have been Emeta, even though she went about it the completely wrong way in the first half of the season. And now she's not her at all, and maybe Emeta herself. I don't know what's going on in that storyline. I don't know that I've ever really cared. I feel sorry for Joe, and that's his place in the show at the moment. He's lost his place in the police force. He isn't around to be part of Team Flash. He's part of this Kramer storyline, which hasn't really gone anywhere and isn't really doing much for me as a viewer, and we've suddenly got two episodes to go. All of that to then at the end of the episode, Nora actually show up from the future, convincing Barry, hey, no, I'm fine, don't worry, Mum's fine, everything you've been worried about for the last 35 minutes of television, absolutely don't worry, we're both here. What do you mean both? Oh, by the way.
Whew, what did I miss?
Dad, meet your son, Bart.
Hey, Dad, what's good?
All of a sudden, we have a Bart Allen, which I wish that I'd stayed off IMDb while watching this episode. I was trying to chase down Adam Craik's actual name to make a note here in front of me, and right next to him, alongside the credits, Jordan Fisher starring as Bart Allen, aka Impulse. And I thought, oh, that's a nice thing to know is going to pop up at the end of the episode. So even though this is a show from 3 years ago, I've still managed to spoil it for myself. That will do us for It's All Part of the Plan for this episode. As I joked about at the top, I would like to say I can't wait to see what we hear over the next 7 days in the land of DC. Usually that's a joke. Usually we hear nothing. Last week we got a title change. We got a logo look. We got a first look costume that ended up being wrong. And we've had denies and allegations of massive mammoth budgets. What possibly could be coming up over the next 7 days? Maybe nothing quite as big, but now all bets are off. Until then, enjoy your DC, and we'll see you back next week for more It's All Part of the Plan.
Get into Geek.